I'm sure Hal sent you copious biographies.
This and that, yeah. Okay. Do you remember your first appearance before an audience, or was that kind of just part of many things of growing up in a family which included other performers?
Well, I don't really remember exactly the very first time, but I think that it was either the moment of birth or when I played the goose who laid the golden egg, which I don't know how I quite managed, but I think I was about 6 or 7.
This is Jack and the Beanstalk.
No, it was a play called The Goose Who Laid the Golden Egg.
Did you have to get up in a feather costume and all for that?
I'm sure I had plenty of feathers.
Was it pretty much expected that you'd be a performer?
I think it was. I think it was something that was in some way predestined or preordained or something that, for sure, I took to like a duck to water, for sure. And then it didn't seem to make my parents unhappy, so they collaborated with me to help me do what I wanted to do. But I never really quite understood that as clearly then as I do now.
Does being a parent now have something to do with that?
Probably. And just a kind of sense of distance and perspective that comes with age.
When you first started appearing with your father, was he kind of schlepping you around to different shows? Or
no.
Were you really into it?
No, that was such a late part of my work and my career. I didn't do anything with him until I was about 16 or 17, and I had already become a committed and seasoned, because I had a lot of experience, actor. And that's all I thought I was going to do. I had no idea I would ever perform in variety or song and dance or in anything certainly like my father's show. It was the furthest thing from my mind, but there was no work for me as an actor when I was 16. And he had the show, and somehow I had that urge to get out there. So I learned this song, Romania, Romania, by rote, and I went out and sang it. Next thing I knew, I was a variety performer overnight.
Did you get into any of the comedy aspects of what Mickey Katz was doing at that time? Or was Mickey Katz into that part of his career at that point?
Well, that was the beginning. That was kind of the height, actually, of the records, of all the parodies. And earlier than that, he just used to tell jokes at home and entertain friends, and sometimes up on the bandstand when he was essentially a band leader on the Good Time steamer, Good Time boat in Cleveland, Ohio. And he lived the life essentially of a musician. I think that if he had his druthers, he would have become Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw. Those were the people that he somehow was focused on, not emulating, but identifying with. And I think it was just a quirk of fate that somehow either he had to stay in Cleveland or whatever the breaks were for him to become an instrumentalist or a soloist or a star clarinetist just didn't happen. And so he started to develop his talents in another way and therefore became a kind of a Spike Jones clone. There was a group called the Corn Cobblers. There were a number of those kind of madcap funny bands that he really kind of took to very naturally. And then, he went out with Spike Jones. You know, he was the guy who did the glugs. And following that, he left Spike and started one day, as a joke, as a matter of fact, I think on a Spike Jones session, he started to do a Yiddish version of what Spike had done with his own crazy version. And one of the very wasp heads of RCA Victor Records thought it was most amusing. And they decided to make this record. I think the first record was Hay Muffin Range.
Home on the Range?
Right. And they didn't know what he was saying, but they thought it was really funny. Oi, geb mir a heim mit a weibele Shane. I thought it was funny, too. I still do. As a matter of fact, I think he's funnier now than I ever did. And I get enormous pleasure listening to his records. You know, when you're a kid, you don't really appreciate a lot of things.
Do you think your father wanted to work in the more straight-ahead jazz playing? Because you mentioned Artie Shaw and Benny.
Oh, yeah, he loves to play jazz, and he loves to play Dixieland, and he still plays it. And they still stand up for him when he does.
Does he perform very much?
Occasionally. Gets up there, and when he does do it, they really love it.
We have some Mickey Katz recordings. First, Mazel Tov Dances. Now, I haven't had a chance myself to listen to that many Mickey Katz recordings. I think there's something of a resurgence now, although I don't think you can buy the records, but people seem to be playing them, at least collectors and so forth. Do you have any memories of this particular session?
Yes, I do. The whole resurgence of klezmer music. This is what that was. A whole bunch of Hollywood studio musicians getting together to play music from their childhood, from their past, from their souls. They would get together and play it just for the joy of it with my dad. And I remember hearing this kind of music from the time I was very tiny. It means a great deal to me.
Well, let's listen to it.
Mazel tov, Mazel tov, Kinder, und für alle sein Gesehen.
Congratulations!
Sit for the machetonima, huh?
Mazel Tov Dances featuring Mickey Katz, and Joel Gray is my guest. Mickey Katz, your father is a wonderful clarinet player, and I wasn't as aware of that until I heard recordings like the one we just heard, because, you know, in the comedy work that he does, like St. Louis Blues or something like that, The playing itself is sometimes obscured by how funny and how clever he is as a performer, but he's a terrific clarinetist.
Yeah, a lot of the Hollywood musicians, they come around and just kind of listen to him with a kind of special respect.
Do you think people from klezmer backgrounds are trying to get in touch with him or reactivating his music? Because you had mentioned that that might be helping people get back into the music of Mickey Katz or at least become aware of it.
He's getting a lot of attention, you know, that he hadn't had before. He's like the master, which is nice. It'd be fun for him to give a master class, if there is such a thing. You know, it's wonderful that when you come to a certain point where you become the teacher and it's time to give it back. He was always like that. I mean, he was very generous and modest, and he's a very nice man.
Well, we have another song coming up. It's a dreidel song. I guess for people who don't know what a dreidel is, should explain it's a top that you spin, and it's something that's associated with Hanukkah.
But that has nothing to do with this song.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit?
The dreidel in the context of this song has to do with a turn, with making a turn in the voice or in the music. So it's not really right on the nose.
It's not that object, but it's the movement.
It's the movement, right.
Yeah. Do you have any recollections
of... A twist.
Do you have any recollections of this session?
No, let me hear it, and I'll tell you if I do.
Mendel make with a dreidel. Berl make with a dreidel. Shimon, can you make a dreidel? That's a dreidel.
Mickey Katz and the dreidel song. It sounds like you knew all the guys that your father played with.
Oh, sure. Sure. You know, when you go to the sessions or... I loved what they did. I loved that music they made. It was very... What's the word? Inviting and seductive and spoke to my soul. Still does. I still get, you know, kind of chills when I hear it.
Were they mostly Jewish musicians or was it just a whole?
No.
Mostly jazz musicians?
Yes. Yes, Cy Zentner was the trombonist, Manny Klein, clarinet, trumpet. Sammy Weiss from the Jack Benny Show was the drummer. Benny Gill. A lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of like would jam.
When your father would perform like in the Catskills or in...
He didn't.
He didn't? Really?
No, that's a total misconception. He went from Cleveland essentially to Los Angeles. He never was a New York person.
Huh, because I was going to ask was, you know, was that a very religious environment?
No, there was almost no religion involved in my life, in the early part of my life, except that we did go to synagogue on the high holidays. And, I mean, that was fine, but my parents did not observe real religious kind of dogma. My father, I think, was very religious himself in his own way, and my mother not at all.
We have one more song that I wanted to listen to, and that's Yiddish Mule Train, which has lots of allusions to things that people will recognize. Is there anything to say about that before we hear it?
No, other than I do it in my act, too, because I think it's that funny.
Let's hear it.
There's a package of salami for a man down in Miami. There's a load of lox and bagels for a cowboy in Las Vegas. There's a dress of Skinner Shepard for a Litvak in Manhattan. Get along, yo! Hey! He can toss around off to the Haymat. We have the other. The old train, yo! The old train, yeah! He live in the club, hurry up, it's time for supper. Hey, give a chocolate, the altish gap. Live in the club, reg map, kiss the please, break the fist. Live in the club, do all the clapping. There's a couple French Eugen for a shamash in Sheboygan. There's a very snazzy hippie for a girl in Mississippi. There's a ballet batish vanner for a schmohawk in the honor. Get along, yo! Indig Faker, der Stick sollte werden. Chicken zipsy, pipsy for a shoychet in Poughkeepsie. There's a shaitel for a bobe in the wilds of Manitoba. There's a messer in diploma for a boil in Oklahoma. Get along, yo! Get along, no, come, shit. Hey, she's broken the places. Hey, my aching back. You know, boys, I'll tell you the truth. The next time I think I'll fly United.
Yiddish Mule Train with Mickey Katz, and my guest on Fresh Air right now is Joel Grey. You were saying that your father would wear cowboy chaps and a hat on stage.
Yes.
You describe
big
that?
Orange chaps and an enormous cowboy hat and a clarinet, and he has this little Irish button nose singing this Yiddish stuff, and with a it was insane.
Part of the of your one man show. Was involved with you changing your name from Joel Katz to Joel Grey. Why'd you change it?
Well, I think there were two reasons. I didn't want to be limited to being a performer who only could do Yiddish and Jewish things, which I was already starting to see the writing on the wall from my dad, that was becoming his specialty and in some ways his limitation. At least he felt that. And since I started as a I was schooled as a classical actor, and Shakespeare and the real plays were all part of my background. I thought that that was would not be helpful, and it was the time when people did change their names. Like Paul Muni was the classic, and John Garfield, and all those. That was what was done.
They had Jewish names?
Muni Weisenfreund was Paul Muni's name. And John Garfield, and, you know, most. That was just what was done. It was part of the way it was. It's just different now. I also was in the show with my dad at the time, and I didn't like the idea that people would think that I got the job because I was the boss's son. So I had this whole fantasy I told myself that they didn't really know who I was. And so that's exactly how it happened, and it was picked at random.
You also got a nose job.
True.
At that time. Why'd you get that?
Probably the same reasons. Plus, all my mother's sisters did.
The Epstein girls.
Yes. And I didn't want to look different.
Your parents encouraged you to take nightclub work rather than finishing school, which was your inclination at the time.
Yeah.
That's
unusual, right?
It sure is, yeah.
Well, my dad is very practical, and my mother was very ambitious for me. So I think between those two things, I think that's why I got that information. It was like a bird in hand and an opportunity at the moment. But I really did dream and hanker and wish for my own self, not for my performing self, for my own whole self, to not perform. I had performed always. And there are many advantages to knowing what it is you do and doing it very early, but there's also a certain amount of isolation and pain connected with it. And I kind of wanted to know what it was like to just be out there without having my identity so linked with what it was I did. I never had real time to discover that.
What did you want to study in school? Or did you just want to unhinge from performing?
Yes. Yes, essentially I did.
What was it about nightclub work that was difficult or disagreeable to you?
Well, I think essentially it was the kind of people that went to nightclubs at that time, and the lack of respect, the lack of quiet, the lack of shape or form or lights, music. Just there were a lot of obstacles and things that I just didn't like in terms of making a first-rate show. It was hard to do.
Do you think being in therapy was something which helped discover parts of yourself that you can use?
No
both
question for... about it. As a matter of fact, it's my opinion that even non-performers, I just think kids, I think one of the things that should be given, along with the ABCs and your times tables and the stuff that you learn in school that's compulsory, is you should be taught some basic tenets of what it is to feel and what your feelings are so you can recognize them. And the basic tenets of therapy, if they were given as tools to young people from the beginning, I think we'd have a lot healthier nation.
Do you think it's something that performers or actors could go through for professional benefit?
No, definitely. Definitely, because the ego is so on the line as a performer. You know, it gets very complicated as to whether they're talking about you or the character, or whether they're talking about you or their fantasy of you. I mean, you start to... It can be very, very tricky to know who you really are.
My guest is Joel Grey, if you're just joining us. 1966, you had the role of the MC in Cabaret, a role which you did both in the stage and the film version. Why don't we listen now to Will Coman, the opening song from Cabaret. This is from the original soundtrack recording of the film.
Velkommen, bienvenue, velkommen. Fremte étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, just wie enchanté. Happy to see you, bleibe reste stay. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome im cabaret, au cabaret, to cabaret.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies und Gentlemen, comment ça va? Do you feel good? Ich bin euer Konferencier.
I am your host und sage willkommen, bienvenue, welcome im Cabaret, au Cabaret, au Cabaret.
Leave your troubles outside. So, life is disappointing. Forget it. In here, life is beautiful. The girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful.
Christine, Mausi, Helga, Betty und Inge.
Each and every one a virgin. You don't believe me? Well, do not take my word for it. Go ahead. Ask Helga.
Willkommen from the original soundtrack recording of Cabaret. What type of research did you do to develop the role of the MC?
I listened to a lot of recordings, early recordings of German cabaret singers, saw movies, but I think that some of my most inspirational work came from looking at the German Expressionist paintings. Books full. I poured through them. I was so turned on.
Just the angular
by those
stuff.
Images and the burst and the angles really did inspire me.
Was it very ironic for you or difficult in any way portraying somebody who's a performer to the Nazis, sort of symbolizing the Nazis in the show? coming from your background?
It was certainly ironic that here I was playing the quintessential Nazi performer and having come from a totally different background. Or are these, is this the other side of the same coin?
What do you, mean?
Is this the black and the white? I mean, are we not all connected? And isn't... ultimately, when I was working in Munich, I came to love a number of people that I had tremendous trepidation about.
Did you talk to many Germans about their war memories or pre-war memories?
Sure.
What would they tell you?
Just like anyone would tell you about anything. They were very different recountings of what went on and ways in which to look at the Holocaust and shame and defensiveness. I mean, just the entire spectrum of feelings you can imagine.
Lottie Lenya was also in the cast, right?
Was on Broadway.
On Broadway. Did she recall, give you any recollections of her leaving Germany or what she was going through when you were doing the role with her?
Yes. Yes, she did. And in some ways, having her in the Broadway production, I was really darting in the dark, as I always do, in terms of looking for not exact attitudes, but feelings and abstractions. That's what interests me, is the stuff that's not right on the nose. And she was kind of my barometer. She kept saying, how do you know this? And I said, I don't know how I know this. But if you say it's right, I'm pleased, you know?
Did you visit any of the camps or try to visit
yes.
any camps?
I went to Dachau, and it was a devastating experience. I did it after I had done all the comedy numbers. I purposely waited.
Are you talking about the production of the film?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, because I knew that it would turn whatever it was I needed to do into something else, and I wanted to protect that, and yet I did not want to not see what I must see.
How do you think Germans on the street related to just the presence of Dachau? I mean, how was it considered when you were there? Did people go see it?
When I went there, we couldn't find it. Nobody knew where it was, and it was like four blocks away. And it, Germans that we asked, they didn't have a clue, or at least that was the position they took. But that was 15 years ago. I don't know what it's like today.
Was the Kit Kat Club, the club that was that you were the MC of, was that based on any...
I think it was based on a club that Hal Prince went to when he was in the war, when he was a soldier. But nothing specific.
The white face and lipstick, did that have any... Was that based on how people would appear in the clubs?
No. That was based on something I dreamt.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I wanted the character to be realistic, and yet like a marionette, definitely like a man, and definitely like a clown, and definitely androgynous. But I didn't even know those things. I was looking for some kind of an abstraction so that it would have reality and also in some way have kind of symbolic overtones.
Did you perform in front of German audiences at all? What was their reaction like?
Oh, they thought I was German. They thought I was their friend. They believed it. And at the end of the shooting, and I did a lot of the songs, I learned them in German so I could perform them for them and get a real response from them. And I remember at the end of the shooting when the assistant director... These people I'd been working with for 6 weeks in the audience who had been watching all these numbers, and almost none of them spoke English. And when he explained that the shooting was over and that I was leaving, that I was going back to America and that I was American and that I don't speak German, it was like they had been crushed with a tremendous mallet on their heads. They felt betrayed, and I felt bad. It was one of those tricky feelings where we got what we needed for the film, but there was something that really confused those folks.
Something somehow deceptive.
Yeah.
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 Well, let's hear another number from the show. I'd like to play If You Could See Her.
I knew you were going to play that.
Why?
That's my favorite.
Oh, yeah?
No, but I knew it. You know, it's the most powerful of those songs.
Let's hear it.
I know what you're thinking. You wonder why I chose her out of all the latest sins of the world. It's just a first impression. What good's a first impression if you knew her like I do? It would change your point of view. If you could see her through my eyes, you wouldn't wonder at all. If you could see her through my eyes, I guarantee you would fall like I did when we're in public together. I hear society moan, but if they could see her through my eyes, maybe they'd leave us alone. Can I speak of her virtues? I don't know where to begin. She's clever, she's smart, she reads music. She doesn't smoke or drink gin like I do. Yet when we're walking together, they sneer if I'm holding her hand. But if they could see her through my eyes, maybe they'd all understand.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, I ask you, is it a crime to fall in love? Can one ever choose where the heart leads us? All we ask is ein bisschen Verständnis. A little understanding. Why can't the world leben und leben lassen? Live und let live.
Oh, I understand your objection. I grant you the problem's not small. But if you could see her through my
she wouldn't look Jewish at all.
That's If You Could See Her from the soundtrack of Cabaret, my guess.
You know, they tried to cut that ending.
Who did?
All the powers that were making the film thought that people would have thought that the film itself was anti-Semitic rather than a statement against anti-Semitism. And I fought like a Trojan and insisted. We did it two ways.
What was the other version that was not released?
If you could see her through my eyes, she isn't a Miskite at all.
What's Miskite?
Ugly person.
And not at all the impact of, of the line at all?
No. But I trusted. You know, I knew the clarity of it. But we had the same problem on Broadway, and it was cut from Broadway.
Really? Boy, I remember seeing the film, and I don't think that would have occurred to anybody. And I mean, like, the intention seemed perfectly clear. You had mentioned that you were able to pull on your own nightclub experience in doing the MC. That was a... Did that really come into play a lot in film?
Yeah, I based a lot of the way the character behaved on all those crumbs that I saw during those early years that I thought, oh, my God, look at him.
You mean the guys that would introduce you?
Right, or the guys that would be on before me or after me or that I'd even see. Oh, please save me. Don't ever let me live that life. So there I was, living it.
Do you think there are any mixed career blessings of such a strong role as the MC in Cabaret that you played?
I don't think so.
It's pretty positive all the way.
You
don't get tired of being identified with that.
Never. I don't walk around with makeup on either. But it's fine. It's fine. And it was fun to be able to follow that with playing the quintessential Irish-American. I mean, it was like they couldn't find a part for a Jewish person for me. Nazis and Irishmen.
Yeah.
And then I played the King of France, the Dauphin, in a musical called Good Time Charlie. Played a major wasp clairvoyant in a movie called Man on a Swing with Cliff Robertson. It was like all the stuff that was part of my beginnings was not available to me. It was really odd until I did a play called The Grand Tour, which was based on Jakubowski and the Colonel. And in that, there was a wedding sequence in which I had to do a dance to music that was similar to that music my father played when I was a kid. And all that came together.
Well, listen, thanks a lot for being here today.
It's great to be here. I had a good time.